webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment that you saw yourself in God and God in you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Love it does not vary long.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast, July 12, 2012, where we hope you can stay with us for the next hour of fun and freedom. You've joined Mike Williams Ministries in the Gospel Revolution, where we will be exploring exactly why the gospel is called the good news. Over the next hour together, we'll explore the Kenyan Corner with Moses Gata, visit the Pastor Asks segment, catch up with the news of the world, and hear from the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution. So sit back, settle in, buckle up, and enjoy the ride. I'm Barris Bartlett, coming to you from the studios of the Gospel Revolution here in Nashville, Music City, USA, or as we like to say here, Southern Fried with Southern Pride. And
this is Michael Williams in Houston, Texas, as I like to say. Glad to be with you today.
Why don't bees go to heaven and trees go to heaven? Amoeba, krill, and fleas go to heaven. It's not surprising that they're not arising.
Mike, this week we got an email question from Pastor Ted Winsett for the Pastor Asks segment, and I noticed that he included his wife this time, so it's actually the Pastor Asks segment from Pastors Ted and Pat Winsett, and I was wondering, maybe he includes his wife now so that he can lay the blame off on someone. But anyway, he writes this: Dear Mike, as you know, Alabama is in the heart of the Bible Belt. People here are steeped in traditional religious beliefs, especially the issue of having to believe in Jesus. I try to tell them that according to John chapter 12, no one could believe. Now, since the cross, people say we have the option to believe. They say we must believe in Jesus to go to heaven. If not, we will go to hell. Please explain this issue and help us find a way to explain it to others. Thanks, Pastors Ted and Pat Winsett. Welcome, Pat. Good to see your name on this email as well. Mike, I think what I hear is, how do we explain this to others?
Well, the thing of it is that I think Pastor Ted is doing a marvelous job at explaining it. Here is the key to sharing truth and understanding and learning truth. You can't teach truth to someone who has no questions. So always, first off, Pastor Ted, don't be surprised when you're trying to explain something to someone who is defending their position, because that means they are pretty well closed off anyway. But the whole issue of explaining this and the validity of it, first off, you do have the prescription of understanding this, which is in the book of John, and we have chapters 1 through 11 and a half that take us into in-depth requirements. This is where the option to believe shows up. The option to believe is not after the cross. The option to believe was before the cross. Wasn't all of this before the cross? In fact, do you realize that there's several chapters in the book of John beyond chapter 12, and chapter 13 starts with the process of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. From there on in, it's just the story. It's the story of Jesus going to the cross for the sin of the whole world. So here at this pivotal point, chapter 12, we have not only the statement that the people didn't believe. Please remember that the criteria for establishing truth is the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. And here we have the writer of John quoting the prophets two times and explaining not only did they not believe, but John explains why. Because God blinded their eyes and stopped their ears, because God had a plan, because God was working to redeem the world, not with man's belief, but with man's unbelief. The key to our redemption was not our belief. For mankind, the key to our redemption was our unbelief. Now, that turns Christianity on its head, but it is true. Paul makes the statement in Romans that at the point that God concluded all to be in unbelief, that that is the moment that he died for the sin of the world. All had to be concluded in unbelief. Is John 3:16 before or after the cross? John 3:16, John 4:16, 5:16, 7:16, 8:16, 9:16, all the way through, these are all before the cross. These are stories that are related in the gospel according to John. And in fact, we did an entire teaching on the book of John that will be very helpful. I don't know, Pastor Ted, if you have that series or not. If not, call Jeff and tell him to send it to you immediately. I think it will be of a great help. And you can share it with others also. And remember our copyright law. If you got one of my series, it is the law. You must copy it and pass it on. If you sell it, send me the money. If you give it away, don't worry about it.
Gospel Revolution.
Mike, we've started a new series, and we're going to be covering some of the material that's in your book. You and I talked about the concept of perhaps spending a week a chapter. The only problem is that this week we can't even get to the first chapter because there's so much other material that's really worth exploring. Did you want to tell the folks a little bit about why we're doing this?
Yes. We would like to, as the book is in print as we speak, we want to make people aware of the content of this book, how it's laid out, the purpose of it, the people we are trying to reach with this particular book, one, The Gospel According to Mike. The back cover, of course, having the title, A Gospel Freed from Christianity. There's a whole show in itself. But that's why we're doing this segment, is to, it's kind of a precursor to the book actually coming out, and to help you understand what you're going to be getting when you get the book.
What I've touched on this week is a few things which, frankly, I was curious about, so I hope everyone else is too. You tell so many stories. Sometimes I see you in a rocking chair on the porch of Cracker Barrel, and they don't all make you look good. So it makes me wonder, why do you use so many stories in what is essentially, it seems to me, a study book?
Well, first off, thank you for the old man analogy that you gave me there. I am turning 60 this year, and I am beginning to feel ever much the bit of the old man in the rocking chair. 60 years old is upon me, August the 16th. As you can tell, I have a propensity to tell stories. I'm already trying to tell a story in trying to explain why I tell stories. So the storytelling really is a part of this book, as you pointed out. In fact, each chapter starts with a life story. What I wanted to communicate in the book by telling these stories is not just to communicate, as you said, this it's a very weighty document of text of doctrine and theology. It is very weighty with that. But I thought that because it is such a transition from Christianity, that it was important for the reader to be able to identify with the process of coming to these conclusions. These conclusions didn't just happen in a hothouse of theological debate. This happened in a process of living and of life, also with the intense theological debate and questions that were in my mind and in the questions of everyone around me. I think that the stories, my hope is that the stories will cause people to connect with the reasons for the conclusions on a human level. We are never totally detached from the element of life and living in the process of learning. It is a part of the learning process. Whether you are a theologian, a politician, you're going to find that people's views are formed not just by their research and their study and their schooling. It is also formed in part by their personal life experiences. And as I relate these stories, I think what the reader is going to find is a very real connection to the doctrinal statement that is made in each chapter, that there's going to be an ability to say, I can relate to that. Not just a verse-quoting doctrine book, but as presenting probably the most dynamic shift in the understanding of the gospel, at least in the last 500 years since Martin Luther, and possibly going back even further than that, to have such a focus on the gospel that it is all about one person. It's all about one. The gospel is, as Jesus said, he said the scriptures were all about him. So the storytelling is just a natural part of me. I can talk your ear off. I think it's the real reason I don't have a lot of close personal friends in my life is they're tired of me. They just get tired of me talking and they want to go do something. I love to talk and I love to listen, but I definitely love to talk.
That's a nice segue into the next question I had for you, because all of our lives are a story, and your dedication is, on any level, it's got to be kind of strange, or considered strange, or at least some people. In fact, you've written, the decision concerning this book's dedication has been settled in my heart and mind for decades. It may sound strange for a man to dedicate his life's work to a woman he's been divorced from for over 12 years. Tell me about the Hazel Ruth Thomas Williams, Mike, that you've dedicated this book to, this book one.
Oh, wow. That, again, is a story. Even the dedication is a story. The dedication in and of itself will eventually prompt me to write a book about just the relationship with this one person that I've had in my life. Hazel, sometimes I hesitate about even saying that she was my wife, because our relationship now is closer than it's ever been before. After 27 years of marriage, the divorce officially took place in April the 1st of 1999. And she said it was good that it happened on April the 1st, because then when she told people, then she'd just say, April Fools. So she's quite the character. She has a sense of humor. After you get to know her, after you get to know her, she has a great sense of humor and is a very charming person. She was my wife for 27 years. She instructed me after the divorce that I could not call her my ex-wife, that I could call her my former wife, kind of like Marines. You know, there's no such thing as an ex-Marine. There's former Marines, and I think she kind of felt like the consummate Marine being involved in my life. And believe me, we were in the foxholes and trenches and the battles of this life, oh my, in such an incredible way. So the story of my involvement with Hazel, even as I've stated in the dedication, that without her, this book would never have been published nor written. There is just not a possible way that her involvement in my life, it is
the adhesive. It is the thing that holds all these blocks together. She is the consistent thing in my life. She'll probably get on to me for calling her a thing, but she'll get over it. But we have a lot of fun, and this is somebody that, you know, a lot of times when there's someone that you love, you want to say how much you love them. But my love for Hazel is such a degree that it can only be described by how much she loves me. And the glory of this relationship with Hazel Ruth Thomas Williams truly is found in the dedication and the love that she has had for me and the caring. So the dedication, again, we'll write another book on this and give you a little bit more behind the scenes.
Mike, that's fascinating. But what else fascinated me was the in memoriam that you wrote to Ruth Gustafson. She's apparently passed away. You've got a date of birth and a date of death. Would you like to tell us a bit more about that dedication?
Yes, I would love to. I think the thing that struck me first and foremost about Ruth was just the gut-level honesty about what she was thinking and about what she was feeling. There are few people that will ever reach the level of self-honesty that I saw and believe that Ruth Gustafson had and had come to. The reason that I wanted to do this memorial to her in her memory was because that Ruth, in the short time that I was involved with her, really embodies the entire reasons in my heart and mind for promoting this gospel. Ruth was tormented in mind, emotionally, about being in the will of God. She wept openly in discussing this with me. And she was in fear. And she was disappointed with her life because she felt, well, she knew based on what she had learned from Christianity that she was not in the will of God and was not pleasing to God. Now, Ruth lived a very conservative life, let me say that to you first off, but and should not have had any reason on any moral level as to why that she would not be pleasing in the eyes of God. But nonetheless, this was communicated to her by intent or default, I don't know, but it was communicated to her that she was not in the will of God. And all of the consequences of that resided in her heart. I've often said that the only people who successfully survive Christianity are those who do not take it to heart. This is one of those people who took it to heart, like I did, Barris, like you did, like so many people of the Gospel Revolution. We are made up of a group of people who not only understand that we are all one with God and with each other, but we're made up of a group of people who took Christianity at its word and to the heart. We did the stuff. We knocked on the doors. We gave the money. We believed that if we did not accept Jesus into our hearts, we were going to hell. We believed these things, and we believed in the second coming, all of the eschatology, whether we were on the pre, mid, post, or pan, we were convinced. And most of us had changed our minds on those end time doctrines because we would listen to the other side and say, yeah, you know, I can see that. so we'd change our minds. I do not know of anyone involved in Christianity that has not had an evolution, if you will, in their eschatology about what they thought was going to be at the end. But it's the reason for the memorial to this particular woman was these elements. Number one, the level of honesty, and she accepted what Christianity said to her to the point to where that it took her to a state of being mentally and emotionally distraught. She was distraught when I met her. I understood from others that she had been distraught for years and had not been able to make her way out of this. By sitting and talking with her for a few minutes there in Calgary, I believe on two different occasions, and then just a handful of phone conversations from here to Canada, Ruth was able to accept that she, by living and breathing, was in the will of God. Can you imagine the power that that would bring to someone's life?
Wow.
Am I in the will of God? Do you live? Do you breathe? Then you are in the will of God. This is another one of those dynamic shifts away from Christianity. Because there is not a group of Christians that do not teach, that I know of. I don't know all of them, but there's none with a voice that does not teach an attempt on an individual's part to try to get into the will of God, or that you are out of the will of God. Being in God's will is no longer a variable because of the cross. If you live, if you breathe, you're in the will of God. Ruth had gone through one bout of cancer before I met her and had gone into remission. And then the cancer reoccurred. And the information that I got from those who were closest to Ruth said that the transformation into a peaceful state was remarkable, and that her desire was that everything be done possible for the gospel that set her free be shared with the entire world. This is the reason for the memorial to this precious lady, who was a very precious person in the eyes of her family and her friends. But I am very thrilled that those closest to her got to see a peace come to her life. I share in Ruth's desire to share this gospel with the whole world, and I wanted to put her name in this book, not just as a memorial, but to say, Ruth Gustafson wanted you to read this book and to hear its message because of its impact on her life.
That's precious, Mike. I imagine that every one of the gospel revolutionaries who are hearing this probably are putting themselves in that dedication to the memory of somebody, in as much as we've all been held ransom by this will of God concept. I remember when I was, I couldn't have been more than 13 or 14, I read a poem in a religious book that came through our church, and I think it was called "The Bird with a Broken Wing Will Never Fly So High Again." And I knew that I knew that I was a goner, because I knew that I had a broken wing. So obviously I couldn't reach the heights that God had originally intended for me. I had a broken wing, and that haunted me for years upon years. And it's, I've been listening to your message for about a decade now, and the change in me, and the change in my expectations, and I began to be able to hope again.
Wow. Such a wonderful thing to hear, Barris. You know, I remember back in our my early days in the Word of Faith movement and the Full Gospel Businessmen and all of that, just the issue of divorce. And it was made clear that if you were a divorced person, you could be in the will of God. And then that's when they went in and broke down Paul's comment, I believe it's Paul's, about the good, the acceptable, and the perfect will of God. Well, if you're divorced, you'll never be in the perfect will of God, but you could be in the good or the acceptable level of God's will. I remember it was like somebody lit a fire to me when I realized the lunacy of breaking these three words down. And I stood up in front of a Word of Faith church and I exposed this horrible, detestable levels of being in God's will, the good will of God, the acceptable will of God, and the perfect will of God. And if you're that, quote, bird with a broken wing, you will never be in God's perfect will, but you could be in God's acceptable will. And I went down through that list, and I said, if it is not good, it is neither acceptable nor perfect. If it is not acceptable, it is neither good nor perfect. If it is not good, it is neither good nor acceptable. If you are in the will of God, you are in the good, the perfect, the acceptable will of God. Okay. There are not levels to the will of God. You are either in or you're out, and you're in by the blood of Jesus.
Oh, so preach it, Mike. Sermon. Preach it, Mike.
So this torment of being out of the will of God, Barris, if we had no thrust whatsoever, except this point about being in the will of God, if the gospel revolution had one goal and one goal only, and that is to reveal to this human race, if you live and you breathe, you are in the perfect will of God. The implications of that would be monumental in the understanding and the thinking of humans on this planet. But the gospel revolution doesn't represent just one point of understanding that is a complete divergence away from Christianity. It represents hundreds and hundreds of the same type of points that reaches in and snatches the gospel out of the jaws of Christianity and says, apart from Christianity, the gospel is good news.
That kind of calls for a pretty big amen, doesn't it?
For sure.
Now, you mentioned Calgary, and pretty soon you're going back to Calgary. Did you want to just mention something about that, Mike?
I really do. Number one, I always come away from Calgary with a story. It's always a really incredible one. My friends are there waiting for me. This is one of those places that I go, Barris, that I'm not just going because I have an audience there, but the audience, they have come through all of this with me, and they are my friends. These people are my friends. And to be there with them, number one, is very exciting for me. I go see them. I don't feel like I'm going to a meeting. I'm going to see my friends. And I go there in the summer, and I also go there in January, which proves beyond the shadow of a doubt I love them. For me to fly out of Houston in January at 75 degrees and land many times in Calgary at 10 below zero is all the proof that I need that I do love the people in Calgary. Because everybody knows, if anybody knows me at all on my human level, which is the way I hope you know me, I detest the cold. And it's been really strange, though, here. I like I said, I'm turning 60 in August. I can't stand the cold, and now I can't stand the heat. So I am looking for perfection in climate is my number one goal in life.
Now,
I'll be teaching in Calgary on the subject of living by faith. How about that? We're going in to this seminar with a tremendous amount to talk about the events in the Gospel Revolution, the powerful understandings that have come forth just in the last little while. I'm writing pretty much every day now, and other very exciting things and exciting events that I'll be sharing with the people in Calgary and here on this on our PowerCast also. It's good. So the flight from here to Calgary is, I believe, 4.5 hours. So I just sit back and relax, and we take off from Houston. I land in Calgary. And either in the summertime or the wintertime, thank goodness this time it's going to be in the summertime. Of course, that's coming up just 3 weeks from now. In fact, I think less than 3 weeks. I fly up on the 19th. The meeting begins on the 20th. So for those of you who are within any distance, even in the northern part of the United States, on the northern tier, you are close enough to come to these meetings. So we encourage you to come out. We have people from Montana to come up. In Calgary, we have people come from all around, not just there, but also from the surrounding provinces, from all the way from the East Coast, actually, and all the way from the West Coast of Canada that come and attend these meetings. So, like I said, we'll be teaching on living by faith. And, of course, it will be, again, a radical departure from Christianity about what the gospel says about living by faith.
Well, gospel revolutionaries, you heard it there. And I can promise you one thing. The last two times that Mike visited Calgary, two exceptionally good series of teaching tapes came out of those visits. And living by faith just sounds like, it sounds like the name of a radio program that I would have hosted or been involved in my past. But I can promise you one thing, it won't be what you expect it to be. If there's anything I can promise you about Mike Williams, that's it. If you'd like to know more about it, please go to www.gospelrevolution.com. Just barely halfway down the page, you'll see dates to remember. In there, you'll find phone numbers to book. Phone numbers, if you want to know a little bit more about it, you can call Jeff at the administrative offices of the Gospel Revolution down there in Florida, and we'll be only too happy to help you any way we can. Mike, this week's question from Moses Garter reads, "My question this week is about the ministry of angels to the believers. I have heard preachers teaching about angels and their assignments, that we should be sending them on errands to collect our money when it's stuck, to kill our enemies, to bring people to church, and all manner of things. Others are commanding angels to go with them, opening doors that are closed, to blind those opposing them and bring favors in their direction, to bring the wealth of sinners to the righteous and protect them all throughout. This is still being practiced in many Christian churches today, especially during prayer meetings and when the pastors are blessing the people after the service. Are these things also a gospel issue? What is the ministry or the place of angels in the lives of humanity today? Kindly elaborate about this issue, Mike. Thank you, guys, for the good work. We love you all." Moses, I can assure you that having spent a number of years in a number of different denominations, it's not just on your continent that this is common. It's also common in some churches throughout the world. Mike, what's your take on this?
This is another one of those things, Barris. I remember back during the Word of Faith movement where we were imploring God. We were demanding God to do things by taking a verse completely out of context, command ye me concerning the works of my hands, and we were just ordering God around all over the place. I remember going back to that and the realization that all of the statements before that were comments like, you know, where were you when I did this, and what was your involvement when that happened? And then the next line, which ends up with a, strangely, with a period after it, but if it were kept in context as far as its as far as the order that it's in, it would be the question. I mean, the context even shows you this would be a question, not a statement, and it would be, command ye me concerning the works of my hands? But instead, because of it's minor, but turning a question into a statement, of course, would be quite confusing. But the emphasis on verses out of context, number one, is, of course, a big question. And I remember standing up in front of my first Word of Faith group and yelling out loud, it don't work! And the relief that came to those people. I think, first off, what I would like to say about this question and about what Moses is talking about, as you pointed out, Barris, this is people around the world that are doing, and first thing I would like to respond to is this. It don't work. I'm just too practical, I suppose, you know. People that commission angels over their children every day have had their children die in horrific car crashes, and people who have asked for protection from all kinds of things and can wind up, you know, in devastating situations. Having angels to go collect your debtors' funds, having angels to go and get your money from the four winds of the earth, and all of these things. I know there's Bible verses about it. Angels, however, though, as Moses brought up, I'm very very pleased to be able to say it's not a gospel issue. People can believe about angels whatever they want. Mike Williams, what do angels do today? I haven't a clue. And I think that's the only honest answer that anyone could come up with. Do they have a role in daily life now? I haven't a clue. I don't know. The one thing I do know is people who say that they do know are not being honest with themselves and especially the people that they're speaking to. I think this would be a good place to bring this up. I will comment on it again next program. And do stay tuned because we do want to keep you posted. I know everyone loves Moses, and the reason that Moses did not record his question was because 45 minutes after I spoke with him yesterday in his trip, coming back home on the long journey that he always has to walk from one place to the other, he was attacked by five men and was choked within an inch of his life. He's not able to use his voice at this time. He was robbed. He also saw them coming, and he tossed the laptop over into the weeds, which we purchased for him several months back so that he could carry out more of his work. Well, that's about all the information we have right now. Please do tune in next week. I want to find out how Moses is doing. And this is one of those points, Barris, where that I get upset with Christianity and its decrees about protection. And here is a man that is not only doing all he can do to promote the gospel. I mean, Moses does all he can do to help anybody. And if protection were based on the value or the need of a human being, then Moses would have all the spiritual protection from angels that a person could have. But it did not protect him from being attacked by these marauders. And one might say, oh, but the angel saved him from being killed. And then, of course, if someone were killed in the line of this whole thing, that would be another grateful story. Well, at least they didn't have their children with them. Isn't that a blessing? You know, the Lord kept kids from going along. And if the kids went along, then it would be something else, you know. Well, at least they weren't at home, you know. And aren't we just grateful that angels kept them from being at the house and their whole house would have been burned down? We always have these places. And desperation creates desperation without truth. Desperation without truth creates all kinds of external spiritual persuasions. Please remember, the gospel is about your identity. I don't know anything about angels. I don't want to know anything about angels. I want to know and understand and help you understand who you are, and that whether you are attacked or whether you have a safe journey, that you are the righteousness of God. You are perfect without fault and without blemish. And as Moses recovers from this horrendous attack that he has gone through, and has our love and support in every way, he knows that this attack did not come because, let me tell you what did not come into Moses' mind. It did not come into his mind, and I'm speaking on behalf of Moses, but I know his thinking. He knows that it did not happen because he was out of God's will, out from under God's protection, had sin in his life or any of these things. This is where really the rubber meets the road about this whole issue of spirituality, true spirituality, which is a revelation that the gospel brings us, and superficial spirituality, which is always trying to add some external application.
Gospel Revolution. An email this week from Pep Washburn, and he writes, Mike, I want to pursue more along the lines of Moses Garter's questions from last week's PowerCast. If it is true that the passage in 1 Corinthians is a description of the nature of God, love is patient, kind, not envious, doesn't boast, always protects, trusts and hopes, never stops and doesn't hold a wrong, how does a person reconcile these characteristics with the violence most people associate with the God of the Old Testament?
Well, once again, Pepe wants to dig a little deeper. And Pep is our dig a little deeper guy, for sure. And also the author of a fine book himself. And we're very proud of Pep and his work. This really is an excellent question. Not that Pep needs me to validate the excellency of his question. This actually raises several things, not just reconciling the God of the Old Covenant with this declaration of what love does and does not do. It also says that love holds no record of wrong deeds. Now, that's totally different from the God of the Old Covenant also, not just the issue of love being kind and patient and it's never jealous and all of this, but you see, a lot of times if we just stay within the context instead of getting fixated on parts of a statement, but take the statement in its full, we now are even more challenged to resolve this. Because not only do we find conflict, out-and-out conflict with this statement in Corinthians about love and, quote, the God of the Old Testament, but also the issue of the fact that love never never writes down anything against you. It never holds anything against your account. So obviously, there are two options here. There's the option that that there is a conflict about the scriptures. First off, let me bring our attention back to the fact this is not scripture here where we're talking about. So we have to rely explicitly on the scriptures, which is the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. We do find in the law, the Psalms, and the prophets, the angry God, and the fact that he would be angry no more. We also find in the scriptures, the law, the Psalms, and the prophets, that God was recording man's faults against him. And as is borne out in a reflection of those prophets from the book of Revelation. But now we know that based on the very same prophets that God no longer has a record of any wrongdoings against the human race. This transition from the from before the cross as to how God dealt with the human race to after the cross and how that nature and character is carried out is the greatest failure of Christianity that we have. We must accept the dynamic and drastic change that happened at the cross in God's relationship with man, how it is demonstrated and how it has been carried out. So not only do we see this now, and I think that 1 Corinthians is an exactly accurate portrayal of God on this side of the cross, not only pertaining to the patience and the kindness and all of this, but also to the God who now no longer records a single thing against you. So we must delve into this, and as Pep's question is so vital here, because this causes us to go into these areas that sometimes do get kind of a surface representation, because the issues that we need are so vast. We must cover them. We must cover them in detail. Please keep those questions coming, folks, because this is the very heart of the gospel revolution. The heart of the gospel revolution is not answers, never has been. It's questions.
Questions, questions, questions. Everybody has them. Why don't you send us yours? Some listeners here are new and others have known us for decades. But wherever you are, we want to hear what interests you. We are kind of in the middle of some format changes here at Gospel Revolution, so I promise you there has never been a better time to email us your question, or even just a comment for that matter. I'll read your comments, good or bad, on air, and Mike Williams will answer your questions. How's that sound for a deal? So get busy, and here's where you send your emails. You send them to freedom@gospelrevolution.com. freedom@gospelrevolution.com. So come on now, you know you want to stump us. You know that. I always did. It was probably just the OCD kicking in.
In the beginning, God said, "Let us make man in our own image, male and female, and call them Adam." And it was good. In the fall, the image of God was corrupted, but not forever.
When God created man in his own image, and we're not talking about somebody else creating an image, we're talking about God himself creating man in his own image. And then the fall of man, God knew he would have to destroy his own image. Let me tell you something I know now about the new creation, that your heart is designed by God to suffer, endure, and recover from all loss, no matter how horrific the loss is.
The Image of God. This 6 CD series is available for $48 plus shipping and handling, or download it now for $24 by clicking the download link at gospelrevolution.com. The Image of God. Get your copy today.
Welcome back again to the News of the World for the 12th of July 2012. First story today is about a tambourine player who was tased during the church service by a sheriff's deputy. Now, most churches encourage praise and worship. In fact, the Bible says, make a joyful noise to the Lord. But according to 50-year-old Vicky Sue Beiersdorfer from Edmond, Oklahoma, apparently she went a bit too far, actually. The sheriff's department said that nobody could pay attention to the... Isn't that lovely? The sheriff's department is vitally interested in church in Edmond, Oklahoma, and they said no one could pay attention to the sermon or what was going on, so that's when our deputy was able to take care of the situation. For take care of the situation, read, dragging her outside and tasing her, at which point she smacked him around a bit. Yeah. Okay. Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes' divorce won't be recognized by the Church of Scientology. Now, here's a surprise. There's a belief in the Church of Scientology that marital problems come from undiscussed issues or problems. They also claim that people who follow the religion of Scientology are more likely to stay married. I wonder if that's got anything to do with the fact that they won't recognize the divorce. Here's a story from Hungary. The leader of Hungary's anti-Semitic Jobbik party suddenly discovered that his forebears are Jewish. Now, that would be a smack in the mouth, don't you think? He says, he says, knowing who is a pure race Hungarian is not what counts. The important thing is the way one behaves as a Hungarian. Of course, before this, it was about what was in your blood. Now it's about how you behave. You might be religious if you think behavior is the qualifying factor for purity. Somebody asked me last week if these were real stories. I do not give you a story that I have not researched. Every story I'm telling you is real, or at least it's been reported on by a legitimate newspaper or journalism organization. And I'm just putting that in here because you're not going to believe the next story. Denominations in America are reaching non-competition agreements. This story comes from Atlanta, Georgia. Hoping to reverse ongoing membership losses, several denominations have entered into a non-competition agreement, carving up certain U.S. cities into exclusive evangelism areas. We all need breathing room to build our congregations back up, said a Southern Baptist Convention representative who was at the negotiations. Instead of competing head-to-head now, we can plow our own fields. How extraordinary that the biggest church in America actually admits publicly that it's all about competition. How does it get funnier than this, guys? The controversial agreement, which has received little publicity, establishes boundaries for proselytizing, direct mailing, church planting, and small group formation in the cities of Atlanta and St. Louis, which are being used as a test case. And that's not the end. There's even talk of going international, with the Southern Baptists already mentioning their preference to take China, while the Assemblies of God insist on holding India. Hey, this could be just like one big board game, really. Here's a story about a pastor and the way he got back at his church when he was rejected by them. In Fresno, at the Family Life Center, Pastor Dave Chandler decided to leave the church. Now, it's not clear whether he was pushed or just left, but on his way out, he used a very little-known clause in the bylaws to single-handedly hire a new worship leader that could not be reversed for a couple of years unless a payout of $150,000 was made. So what he did was he found a street entertainer by the name of Bill McNerney, who specializes in alien folk music and tunes for chickens and other intelligent beings. Now, McNerney, who was last employed in Florida, made several albums of himself playing the ukulele and making barnyard sounds. One of the board members said, we are in a real bind. We couldn't believe when this bozo showed up to lead worship. That's some admission that your worship leader is a bozo. And some people are saying, pay him the $150,000 just to get shot of him. And other people are saying, well, it's kind of different. Maybe it'll make people think. I think that deserves the Bonehead of the Day award.
Bonehead of the Day.
Here has to be the story of the week, I think. Sally Warner, 43, became a Christian. She's from California, and she became a Christian while reading the Bible book of Titus in the New Testament. A week later, she was so excited that she submitted a form to the DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles, requesting a personalized license plate. But her request for a plate that read, Titus for you, arrived at her home reading, well, let me put it this way. They left the U out of Titus. I was crushed, Warner said. I couldn't bring myself to put them on my car. The DMV people have been very sympathetic, but they insist I use these plates until the new ones arrive. Warner owns one car and has to drive to work every day. She's a nurse. And she says now other motorists honk at her on the highway and make rude gestures. And not just truckers, she says. Hey, hang on, what's wrong with us truckers? And she often finds notes with phone numbers left on a windshield. Titus for you, minus the U, eh? This Hispanic congregation in Lansing outgrew its host congregation. So they just started a new congregation, and pretty soon they grew. They grew so fast they actually booted out the original host church, and they said, we're taking over. When you're bigger than us, you can take over again. I love the way those Lutherans do it. I just love America. You can. Okay, here is an Alabama judge that gave criminals a choice. Go to jail or go to church. Where is this? This is Bay Minette, Alabama. And down there, under a program dubbed Operation Restore Our Community, the city judge lets misdemeanor offenders serve time and pay a fine or go to jail every Sunday for a year. 56 churches are participating so far, and who can blame them, given the fact that churches' attendance is falling off like there's no tomorrow? Here is an atheist who filed a complaint over a restaurant who gave people a discount if they brought in their church bulletin. He said, I've never eaten there. This is Prudhomme's Lost Cajun Kitchen in Columbia, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And he says, I don't even know the people who run it. I just don't think it's reasonable that they should give people discounts for presenting a church bulletin. You go for it. You might be religious, Mr. Atheist, if you want to force other people to follow your way of behavior. You might just be religious. Dear, oh dear, what's the Vatican up to? Again, the Pope has fired a third bishop for mismanagement of his diocese. More or less blowing out of the water the Vatican's legal arguments that the Pope has no power to remove the bishops who cover up for pedophile priests. This fellow was in, I think he was in Toowoomba in Australia. The other two are, I think one was in the States and one was in Hungary, or was it Bulgaria. But apparently the Pope can fire people for things. He just doesn't, well, hasn't fired any bishops yet for that other thing, you know, the bad thing. This story is about Walmart and its choice of what music it puts on its shelves. Apparently, it wants to reject this racy worship CD. In Anaheim, California, the latest Vineyard Music Worship CD, Intimacy Volume 2, has raced to the top of the Christian sales charts, but Walmart is refusing to stock the album without slapping on a parental warning sticker. The groundbreaking, some say risque, album includes edgy worship songs such as My Lover, My God, or Touch Me All Over, or you might prefer Naked Before You, or I'll Do Anything You Want, Deeper, or You Make Me Hot With Desire. We've had concerns about previous Vineyard CDs, said a Walmart man, but this time they went overboard with their suggestive imagery depicting the church's love affair with Christ. Whoa. It would be irresponsible to sell this to 13-year-old kids. Yeah. We felt this was the next logical step, said a Vineyard Music Group spokesman, in furthering people's intimacy with the Lord. As you know, the Muslim Brotherhood won government in Egypt in the recent elections, and what do you imagine their first order of government was? It was to feed the poor, yes? No. It was to decide that they want to destroy the pyramids. Why? Because they are a sign of a pagan past. You might be religious. If you might... Oh, forget it. Hey, guys, this is News of the World. There is no end to the stories of the ridiculous behavior people will go to when religion is more important than people. So tune in next week for more.
Gospel Revolution.
Coming now to the introduction, Mike, I noticed that you dove straight in with a story about a phone, a take-home food container, and one of your friends having lunch. What is that all about?
Yes, that's one of my friends here in Houston, and we have the opportunity to have a lunch occasionally, not very often. And she has progressed in understanding the gospel, was able to step out of a horrible church situation just a few years ago. So her interest is there, but very glad to have the intensity of Christianity out of her life. Maybe that'll have to be a title of the of a book, The Intensity of Christianity. We're writing books and everything today, Barris. My goodness. We were sitting there talking, and she was trying to understand the concept of what I was saying about the fact that in this new creation, that God and humanity are not separate entities anymore for all means and purposes, all practical purposes. When somebody tries to nail me down on, it's kind of like the way they have always done about Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. It's, you know, they get all excited about these are one, these three are one. Well, if they are one, then they're not three. But if they, you know, so I'm not going to get in the minutiae of all of that. We are one with God, even as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are one. So whatever your determination about that is, we are one. As I made the comment about the, Glenn once asked me a question about the Trinity on a webcast, and I said, well, I said, there's not a Trinity anymore. It's a quad-unity, and a term that was invented on that day that I don't think ever existed on planet Earth before. But the quad-unity of God now is Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and man. That truly is a new creation altogether. Because man no longer stands alone in the eyes of a gracious or a vengeful God. Man does not stand separate in any degree from God himself at all. Now, this is where all the warning flags go up about humanism and Eastern religions and all of these. Believe me, there is no Eastern religion nor humanism that teaches that the power of the cross made us one with God. I'm sorry, that just is not a humanistic view, and it is certainly not a Eastern religion view. This is the power of the cross we're talking about. And just because others have tapped into some realities about the cross is not surprising to me, because they are realities. But the fact that they don't have the understanding of how this took place is the thing that causes them to fall right back into a religious mindset of struggle of some form with religion. So as we were sitting there, my friend took the, she was trying to get this concept, and I said, it's that, let me explain it this way. You know how we've always said, I've talked about the God that is out there. And I said, there's no God out there anymore. The God that we all understand is in here. He is not out there. There's no out there God anymore. And again, I accept that concept because it is a gospel concept. It is a scriptural concept. To say that I understand the full implications of that or how it operates, that is, boy, there's going to have to be people much smarter than me come along with those things to talk about. But as we were sitting there, we had finished our lunch, and I got a half of my sandwich to go. So the waitress had come by, and she had got my sandwich and put it in the styrofoam box, a little square styrofoam box. It was sitting on the table. My cell phone was also laying on the table. And so when I was trying to explain about this oneness, my friend took the styrofoam box and set it on top of my high-tech cell phone. And she said, oh, so it's like this. And she placed it on top of the cell phone. And I said, almost. And I took the styrofoam box and removed it from the top of the cell phone. I didn't want to do this because it was going to spoil my sandwich, but I wasn't going to pass up the analogy for the sake of half of a sandwich. And I took my cell phone and I placed it in the styrofoam box with my sandwich, and I closed the lid and I said, more like this. And her eyes got big as saucers, and she said, oh, I see now. Of course. So that is the reason for the story in that part of the book. Was to introduce the reader to this concept of oneness. The title of the book, after all, is One, The Gospel According to Mike, and A Gospel Freed from Christianity, because all of these concepts, Barris, are things that have nothing to do with Christianity. I don't know how to emphasize that enough. Do not put on the back of my book A Gospel Freed from Christianity just to be edgy or to provoke controversy. I put it on there because it's the truth. I believe that the gospel, in its purity as good news, must be extracted from Christianity altogether to be good news. And when I did this little demonstration of the cell phone and the styrofoam box, then I go on to talk about then how does the styrofoam box, us, and the high-tech phone, God, operate as one. Well, obviously, it's going to take a good news gospel to get that to happen. So I'm not sure the gospel has ever been written or revealed about how a styrofoam box and a cell phone can operate as one, but we do have a revelation as to how God and man can operate and does operate, whether we like it, know it, or understand it or not. We do operate as one. So this understanding is so very powerful. The realization of this unity, this union between God and man, and that's what the marriage was all about. Marriage is not about what takes place between two people. Paul made that very clear. Marriage was an institution that was implemented to bring a revelation of understanding of what Christ and the church would be according to Paul. I'm not speaking against anyone's marriage. But I'm telling you that marriage was not instituted so that we could have the institution of marriage now. It was instituted so we would understand this perfect marriage between God and man that took place 2,000 years ago at the cross.
When I am down and oh, my soul so weary, when troubles come and my heart burdened be, then I am still and wait here in the silence until you come and sit a while with me. You raise me up so I can stand on strong when I am on your shore.
Well, I can't believe we've come to the end of another show and we still haven't even touched the sides of what we wanted to from just the introduction of Mike's new book, One, The Gospel According to Mike. Thank you for your patience with us while we're working through some audio wrinkles that we have here. I assure you we will get better at this. So come back and join us next week when we'll do the same thing, only better. And here's Mike to say goodbye.
Thanks, everybody, for joining in. It has been a blast. And if you think this was good, hang on to your seats. It will get better and better. We love you a lot. Thank you for loving us.
You raise me.